On this episode of Skeptico.
The point of this life couldn't be about reincarnation because we're not there now.
The irony of it is, if you want to believe in reincarnation, and I'm kind of an agnostic about it myself, but if you want to believe in reincarnation, then this is your future life right here. Here is your reincarnation, you know. So if it is about your next life, well, here you are in your next life as viewed from your past life. And are you any less confused now?
At the same time, let me jump over to the other side, because the best evidence we have suggests there's a very strong case for reincarnation. Are you familiar with that body of work?
No, not at all.
Man, I am blown away when I talk to you Zen guys and you don't know about the scientific research on reincarnation.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and as I may have mentioned a couple times on this show, there is a Zen monastery not too far from where I live here in San Diego. It was established by the wonderful and venerable Thich Nhat Hanh quite a few years ago, and it's still going strong today, and it's very open to the public. In fact, on Sundays, anyone can visit, and I have a couple of times, and it's a great experience. You have a chance to enjoy the beautiful grounds, do a walking meditation, which Thich Nhat Hanh is somewhat famous for, and then there's a question and answer period with some of the senior monks. But the last time I was there, I remember sitting down for that question and answer period, and a woman who was leading the session started out by inviting us to ask questions, but specifying that the questions not be philosophical, but only practical matters of applying the meditation practice. Now, this not only struck me as strange, but it kind of peeved me in a way. First, because most of the questions I have in life wind up being something like philosophical questions. And number two, it just seemed like bad form. I mean, that's kind of a bad way to start a question and answer period, is to limit the questions. I mean, I sat there and listened, and there were some really bad non-philosophical questions too. That's not to say that there couldn't have been some bad philosophical questions as well. But the real takeaway from the whole experience came later when I realized the distinction that I had made. Rightly or wrongly, I had chosen at that point that this wasn't really the right path for me. Now, that may not sound like a big deal. It's not like I was going to go join the Deer Park Monastery and sit on a cushion for the next 20 years of my life. But on another level, aren't we all trying to make these distinctions all the time? Aren't we all closing down paths of inquiry as we try and untangle this crazy mess of who am I, why am I here questions? I know I am. And that's what really keeps Skeptico so alive for me. That's why I love doing these interviews like the one I have today with Zen teacher and ex-punk rocker Brad Warner. And what makes this particular conversation so interesting is that in talking to Brad, I encountered someone who's walked a similar path and has tried to make similar distinctions in his pursuit of the biggest of the big picture science questions. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Brad Warner. Today we welcome Brad Warner to Skeptico. Brad is a highly regarded Zen practitioner and teacher who's brought a punk rock sensibility to Zen with books like Hardcore Zen and Sit Down and Shut Up. And Brad's latest book, titled Don't Be a Jerk and Other Practical Advice from Dogen, Japan's Greatest Zen Master, is in that tradition as well. So, Brad, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, I think it's really neat. And, you know, Eugene is a listener of Skeptico and kind of connected me with what you're doing. And I'm really glad he did. I love when people kind of pull me in directions that I'm not necessarily looking. And then I make these interesting kind of connections. So I hope that's what we can do today.
Sure.
Because this show, you know, Skeptico is really about science and spirituality. At least that's kind of what I tell people, because it's really about finding the truth in God. And yeah. not that I really believe in God in a literal sense, or that I even believe in truth in a literal sense. But what I think you can understand where I'm coming from, because what struck me in kind of digging into your story a little bit is that I kind of felt a certain kinship there with you being someone who was looking for truth in a way that probably someone from the outside would be, really? That's where you're looking for truth, playing in a punk band? But that really was what you were about. Can you fill in that story?
Yeah, well, that was the first thing that got me into punk rock was this. I was young and I liked the vibrancy and urgency of the music, but what I really cared more about was the fact that it was really, really honest, whereas most of the music that was around at the time struck me as posturing and dishonest. So I thought maybe these guys, these punk rock guys, have the truth that I'm seeking. You know, I was a bit young for that scene. You know, these guys were mostly in their mid-20s, and I started when I was like 18 and going to the shows and joining the band Zero Defects and traveling around with them. But the punk rock sort of disappointed me in it started to get big, and you had a lot of people who were coming to the shows who just saw the violence and the noise and wanted to start fights with people, and it just really kind of lost its way. Around the same time, I was a student at Kent State University, and I happened to take this class called Zen Buddhism, and it struck me as being the most punk rock thing I'd ever encountered, in that it wasn't enough to just question society and question your peers and question the musical environment and all that stuff. You did all that, but then you went deeper and questioned yourself and how you were part of the very thing that you were rebelling against, which was something I'd never considered, you know, that even I was something I had to rebel against. You know, so that's and Zen Buddhism kind of asked those questions, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I think that's really cool, and I can totally relate to it from a skeptico sense. You know, I started the same way with science. You know, I said, okay, I have these questions about truth because my life up to this point has been great, but there's this gnawing sense that there's something to be known, something to be revealed that I haven't found. Sure. Hey, these guys over here, or these science guys, they say they're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And I followed that path and I kind of found that it's kind of bullshit. I mean, they weren't really following the data wherever it leads. They weren't really looking for truth. They were in a lot of ways doing what we all do, trying to, you know, bolster our belief system and not change so that we can hold on to the stuff we feel comfortable with. But I think in that process, you know, in the same way that punk rock sensibility, I think you can still feel it in your writing and what you do. I think that scientific sensibility that kind of says, hey, if we are here and we are here, then we can kind of construct these certain rules and play with those rules in a way that gets results that at least feels like we're nudging towards the truth.
I have a lot of respect for science. One of the things that got me interested in Buddhism in the first place was it was the first religion, and I don't think it's the only religion, but it was the first religion I'd ever encountered that wasn't terrified of science. My initial forays into religion were, I was growing up in rural Northeast Ohio, and basically religion was the kind of evolution fearing, you know, kind of the earth is flat sort of, you know, they didn't quite go that far usually, but that sort of head in the sand kind of thing that we're not going to look at what's going on. So I have respect for science and the scientific method. I understand that it often goes awry, but at its core, I think it's the right way to look at things. And I believe that, Buddhism emerged at a time before there was this strong division between what's called science and what's called religion and what's called philosophy and what's called, you know, whatever else. These kinds of inquiries into the truth were all considered sort of the same thing. And I think it's one of the few that still exists that owns up to the idea. They never had this division between spirituality on one side and materialism on the other. I have to qualify that in saying that there are certain Buddhists that do make that division. But I think Buddha himself was very adamant that both sides have to be included in the equation if you're going to understand reality. And I feel like maybe the mistake that science, I don't know if it was a mistake, but science initially emerged in the West as an extremely materialistic sort of endeavor. So it was looking only at the material world.
Right, but I think that's kind of a misunderstanding of it in some ways, in the same way that, I might be wrong here, but yeah. I always saw Zen as somewhat misunderstood in that if you take it too literally, it kind of falls apart anyway. I mean, we're just playing with ideas here with Zen. And
sure,
I kind of felt like science was the same way,
yeah.
And it's become misunderstood, but it's become a religion. I mean, what I always saw science was, if you really get to the soul of it, was, yeah, we're playing a game here, and we know we're playing a game, and we're going to put the blinders on, and we're going to pretend like there's a reality out there, and we can measure this reality with our five senses. But we know it's not just that, but let's see where we can get if we do that. And I kind of feel like – I really feel like that's partially the attraction to your work is – and this latest book, Don't Be a Jerk, is you've always been about stripping away – the bullshit with this kind of punk rock sensibility and saying, okay, yeah, but it's not really like that. Let's get to the core of it. And then I think that's kind of what you're, and you have to do it a couple of different ways, right, Brad? Because one, you have to do it, you have to strip away the Western materialistic bullshit that's emerged from this scientific materialism we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And you do that. But then I think what you've also done is you've also said, hey, as a Westerner, I don't mean to be impolite here, but I need to strip away a little bit of that stuff that you guys have added on in Japan and in the East. And, you know, let's try and get to the core. So do you want to speak to that and how that particularly relates to this latest book of yours, Don't Be a Jerk?
Well, there's a lot of cultural baggage and stuff. And I've had discussions with people. I lived in Japan for 11 years. So, excuse me, my approach to things that are Japanese – that exist within the within Buddhist philosophy and with Zen philosophy is maybe a little different because I kind of feel like I have a more intuitive sense of where it comes from, so it doesn't seem so exotic and foreign to me, you know, and weird. But you do have a certain amount of stuff like that. If you take it too literally, you're going to go wrong. There's a chapter that I did in Don't Be a Jerk in which I tried to look into the question of reincarnation, because reincarnation is such a huge, it's almost kind of become an industry for Buddhists in the West, and it's a huge selling point. People are fascinated by reincarnation. I think a lot of people get into Buddhism in the West specifically because they want to hear about reincarnation. And Dogen, who is the person I'm writing about in this book, this 13th century Buddhist philosopher from Japan, is he comes across, you could argue both ways about his views on reincarnation. There are points in Shobo Genzo, in his book, where he seems to be utterly unequivocally anti-reincarnation. He says human beings, once they die, do not return to life again, and he has statements like that. But then there are other areas in the text in which he sort of goes into the various little beliefs and folk ideas that are usually included under that kind of lump heading of reincarnation as if he believes them. And I had a little argument with a guy who's a much better Dogen scholar than I am, who told me that no way, Dogen definitely taught reincarnation, and I don't think he did. I think he used the mythology of reincarnation in order to express ideas about other things in the practice. But whether he believed it himself or not is a kind of a question I ask myself within the text, and I end up kind of saying, well, maybe he believed it. But whether he believed it or not, it's really clear that he did not think it was terribly important.
You know, I thought that chapter was really interesting, and I thought it'd be a great, great focal point for this interview, because that is really the meeting point between what you do and what I do on Skeptico here, and that's to try and tease apart these impossible to understand kind of topics. And yeah, before, you know, so that chapter is titled, chapter 6 in your book, Did Dogen Teach Reincarnation? And Does It Even Matter If He Did? Which I think is a great play with the concept. And what I also like, and maybe you could share this with folks, is, you know, just a little snippet you do about the Kurt Vonnegut analogy, because I think it's so apt for reincarnation.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd love to – maybe I should go on the internet after this interview and look it up and see if I can find it. But I just remember years ago reading an essay that Kurt Vonnegut wrote as advice to writers. And he said his advice was never put a love story in a book, and that he doesn't do that, because anytime – a reader sees a love story, they will focus on the love story and forget everything else you're trying to do in the book. And I feel the same thing happens for Buddhist teachers once you start talking about reincarnation. People, especially American people and to a certain extent Europeans, will just latch on to that reincarnation stuff and never let go. And then you just find that you're spending the rest of your life talking about reincarnation, which to me is not all that interesting, you know, to be honest.
It can't possibly be the point of it. It has to be, in the way you framed it there, it has to be yet another distraction, right? Because the point of this life couldn't be about reincarnation, because we're not there now.
The irony of it is, if you want to believe in reincarnation, and I'm not sitting here saying I'm kind of an agnostic about it myself, but if you want to believe in reincarnation, then this is your future life right here. Here is your reincarnation, you know. So if it is about your next life, well, here you are in your next life as viewed from your past life, and are you any less confused now than in your past life? Well, you don't remember it, but, you know, I would say that you're just sitting around being confused about everything, and getting reincarnated didn't really relieve that. So yeah, it's obviously, even if there is reincarnation, then obviously that is not the answer.
Yeah, I like the way you just put that. At the same time, let me jump over to the other side, because I do take the scientific angle or the scientific method that drives us towards reincarnation. So the best evidence we have suggests there's a very strong case for reincarnation. So Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia, who's followed up with the work of Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia. Are you familiar with that body of work?
No, not at all.
Man, I am blown away when I talk to you Zen guys and you don't know about the scientific research on reincarnation. I talked to Stephen Batchelor a few months ago, and same thing. There's like this dead silence. It's like, no, these guys have used the best methods possible in terms of sociology and anthropology to study whether there's any realness to reincarnation. And they say, yeah, there is. And they've compiled thousands of accounts. And they're not Buddhists. I mean, they don't go into it with a preconceived notion that they have to support this for any religious reasons. Yeah. And I'd also say, you know, like you mentioned in that chapter, you refer to the movie that many people have probably seen and the book, Heaven is for Real, about this kid named Colden Burpo, who's a minister's son, some small Midwestern town, and he has this near-death experience. But to me, I mean, what's missing in your story, and I understand why you're kind of playing off the kind of Christian reinterpretation, co-opting of the near-death experience, is, hey, there's a ton of science behind this thing called near-death experience, done by doctors who've just... it's just come up spontaneously, right? I mean, somebody has a heart attack and they're in there fiddling with their heart and there's no way they should have a conscious memory of this. And the next day they say, hey, doc, I remember what you said when I was on the table. You said, hey, how does this guy have a heart like this? I remember when you said that. The doctor goes white as a sheet. And he says, how do you know that? He goes, well, I was out of my body. I was outside here and I could see everything that was going on. But you know, you were clinically dead. Yeah, I saw when they resuscitated me. I mean, these aren't just accounts. These things have been studied scientifically as much as we can. And they clearly come back over and over again saying that there is some kind of conscious experience following death. And I don't know what that means, but I'm not comfortable sidestepping that with, oh, well, you know, it's all just a story that we're telling ourselves.
Well, you know, I don't know. I feel that there might be something to that, but then again, you know, ultimately I kind of go with Dogen's view that it's not the important matter. The important matter is what we're doing right now, because like I said, even if there is reincarnation, then I'm still just as confused as I was in my past life, so I better get on with it. So I you know, I think these are, you know, they're interesting. I'm more interested let's see, if I'm going to speculate about something, I'd be more interested in speculating about life outside of planet Earth or something like that. But there you go. It's an interesting area.
And I guess that's the intersection with science and also with speculation. Because when you say speculate, there's all sorts of different ways to speculate. So the whole introspection is speculation, right? So we can have this deep introspection and have these profound experiences. And I think that's one of the real, well, this is just purely my opinion, but one of the real strengths of Zen from a spiritual perspective is to say, don't get too distracted by all the fireworks that might go off if you do this. But at the same time, we're all looking for a grounding, and I am drawn to this shared experience grounding, which is what science is. Science is this shared experience, this consensus reality, this we can measure things in this way if we try kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And when that pulls us in another direction, I'm inclined to put more weight on that because there is a methodical way of trying to figure that stuff out. I guess my question would be, what is Zen's method, or what part of the Zen method of discovery of truth really draws you towards it?
Well, what interests me is Dogen taught a type of meditation called Shikantaza, which means just sitting. So there's no goal to the practice, which is something I don't know, I see a little bit of a parallel with the scientific method in that you are not attempting, you know, good, of course there's plenty of bad science where you decide what outcome you want and try to make the experiment produce that outcome, or try to massage the data until it looks like what you want it to look like. But the good science doesn't do that. Good science is honest and accepts whatever the data provides you. And that's what we're trying to do with this style of meditation. So rather than fixing your mind on a specific sort of thing you want to happen, such as an enlightenment experience or mindfulness or self-discovery even, or any of that, you just sit. And the sitting is a specific physical posture that you take, and you sit with your eyes open, which is kind of unusual among most forms of meditation. But you sit with your eyes open because you're acknowledging the outside world as part of your practice. So you're just trying to remain with whatever happens. So if it's you know, I don't know, Krishna descending from the sky with 18 arms offering you gold and incense and myrrh, then you accept that. And if it's usually not that. What it usually is, oh, God, I hate sitting here like this. And damn it, I wish that guy with the bell would ring the bell. This is boring. Or you're thinking about, you know, whatever you're thinking about, you just allow all of that to happen, to take place, and try to pull back a little bit and observe it from I don't like to use the word detached, but a slightly detached point of view. So we are not involved with the the messes your own mind makes, but you allow the mind to kind of process things as it will without getting too much, without attaching too much of yourself to it, of this idea of this is my experience. You're just kind of letting experience right. happen.
What do you think drew you to that, or, you know, why were you drawn in that direction? What clicks for you about that? And do you think there's something special or unique about that particular practice?
Well, I do think it's special and unique, and I end up having these discussions, or sometimes you get into it on the internet with people who think you're being kind of a fascist or a televangelist about it. But if I didn't believe fully in this stuff, I wouldn't be practicing it for so long. So that's my, you know, that's my where I'm coming from. So I do think it's unique, and why? I suppose because it's honest, because there's no further you can really go as a human being than that. I feel like if you are trying to make something happen with your meditation, you've already prejudiced the experiment, as it were, if we're going to use that metaphor, by saying what you want the results to be. So you step away from that and don't expect anything. And that seemed to me to be a really radical sort of honesty, because it was, I ended up describing it like this way, I'm not sure if it's in the current book or in the previous book, but it's like, if I want to know, yeah, it was in the previous book about God, where I took it from the standpoint of God. And my feeling about God was, I want to know if there's a God or if there isn't a God. You know, if there's not a God, I want to be able to...
Isn't that an unknowable question? Again, in the same way that we were talking about earlier with science, it's like science only makes sense when you take a step back and say, a wink and a nod, okay, we're just playing a game here, guys. There isn't anything real to measure, but let's pretend that it is, and now let's go forward, and we can create iPhones and all this great stuff when we do it. It's kind of the shut up and calculate model of science. Shut up means ignore the fact that there is a certain unrealness to all this stuff, but let's go ahead and forget about that and do it. That always kind of gets me about Zen. It's like, I'm with it. It's awesome. That's great. But at the end of the day, we're just playing another game here. It's not a meta game. It's just part of the same game that we're all playing.
It depends on what you mean. There's an idea in Buddhism that's really difficult for, you know, largely misunderstood, and say idea of emptiness. And a lot of people will look at Buddhism and this idea of emptiness and think it's a nihilistic idea. But emptiness is not a nihilistic idea. It's kind of what you're saying. It's the idea that ultimately everything is unknowable except provisionally. You can kind of, right. You know, I know my address, but I might move, and that won't be my address anymore. You know, things change and things grow and whatever, metamorphosize and whatever they do. But you can have a pure experience of this moment as it is, and that's what we're calling reality. So there is my teacher was interesting in that he would insist on this kind of unknowability of certain things. People would ask him about enlightenment, and he would say, you can't possibly know if you're enlightened. And then you're kind of going, well, why am I doing this practice if that's true? But on the other hand, he was very insistent that there is a reality. It's just that our minds try to deal with reality by breaking it up into parts that the brain can work with and manipulate and make sense out of. But those parts are never the whole, because the brain can't encompass the whole of reality. So that's where emptiness comes in. There are certain things that are just beyond your knowing, and you accept that as part of what you're doing and get on with it.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you didn't say this, but I guess I'd like to hear your comment on this. To me, it all connects with the saying, you know, one Buddha always recognizes the other Buddha, you know. So it's kind of like every path has to kind of by definition lead to the same because there's only one thing to begin with. You know, I was just listening to Krishna Das, who is this pretty famous kirtan singer and follower of Neem Karoli Baba. And he was telling a story about being with, you know, his master, his guru, Neem Karoli Baba. And he grabs this notebook out of his hand, and Krishna Das has been on this kind of spiritual quest throughout India, and he's written down all these things. And one of the things he's written down is this very old Buddhist prayer, I guess you would say. Baba goes, "Hey, okay, read that to me." And he has someone translate it. He goes, "Oh, okay, very good. Keep reading that. That's good." And then he says, "Me Buddha, I'm Buddha," you know. And I think in – so again, this is as far from a non-dual practice as you can get. Mm-hmm. It's purely a devotional practice, right? It's a Hindu devotional practice. But it's all the same. He recognizes Buddha. He recognizes Jesus. Even if there isn't a historical Jesus, he recognizes it as, you know, just another path, just another wink and a nod of playing with these ideas of what – else, you know, what's next, what's bigger.
Sure, it's all the Nishijima Roshi used to say, reality or the truth is only one. That was his thing that he used to like to repeat. So there's one truth, there's one reality, and we're all experiencing it, but we have different ways of processing it, which have to do with our personal history and our likes and dislikes and everything else that goes into that. And for some people, one way works, and for other people, another way works. So that exists. But at the same time, you have to, at some point, settle into what's going to work for you and pursue that to its final destination. And I also think that's really important. You know, there's a kind of a tendency within spirituality in America today to want to sample a little bit of everything, which I can see the, I can see the appeal of that, but a lot of times that ends up being a very superficial sort of path, and if you want to get really into it, it's good to kind of pick one method and just go, you know, all the way into it and see where it leads you.
I hear what you're saying. At the same time, and I'm sure you can appreciate this, Brad, I mean, that is a very Zen thing to say, right? I mean, so it's kind of like fits for a Zen personality. That sure would be something that fits. Now, in this book, Don't Be a Jerk, I also love the origin of the book because it's somewhat synchronistic in terms of why you chose to dive back into the Dogen, something you've written about quite extensively. What drew you to really do this kind of extensive deconstruction and reassembly of this really important text, which, as you point out, has kind of managed in small ways to work itself into popular culture as well?
Yeah, well, the original thing that sparked it off was a friend of mine got this book called God is Disappointed in You. And
I love that title, by the way.
it's a great title. And the guy who wrote it, I'd like to meet him. I keep mentioning him in interviews. But he wrote this book. He tried to take the entire Christian Bible and rewrite it in his own words. And it's a funny book. And I feel, I think a lot of certain types of Christians would probably hate the book, but I feel it's respectful to its source material. And this friend of mine suggested that I try to do the same thing with Shobo Genzo, which she knew that I'd written about a lot. And I at first thought that was not going to work, but it was one of those cases where I didn't really have any better ideas, and the idea was intriguing enough that I decided to pursue it. So I just took one chapter of Shobo Genzo and tried to see if I could do that with it. And I enjoyed it, so I went on to another one and another one, and I finally got through 20 or 21, I can't remember, chapters of Shobo Genzo that way and put it into this book. So it was just kind of trying to see whether there was a way to phrase Dogen in a way that would be both respectful to what he initially said and a lot easier for 21st century English speaking readers to understand.
Give people a quick example, like with the title, for example.
Well, that's the title is Don't Be a Jerk, obviously. And it wasn't my first choice of a title for the overall book, but it ended up being, I think, a good place to start. There's a specific essay that Dogen wrote called Shōwaku Makusa, which means avoid doing wrong. And it's, you can kind of look at it as a scholar and parse out the various meanings of why he's saying it and all that. But, when I read it, I felt like he was saying over and over again, just don't be a jerk. The way to behave ethically is when you see what you shouldn't do, and I think all of us at some level are capable of that, just don't do that thing. And he was kind of taking the problem of evil. You know, in the East, they don't really label it the problem of evil like Western philosophy does, but it still exists in Eastern philosophy, this idea that why is there evil in the world? It's different for Buddhists because they don't believe in the devil and anything like that, but it's still a problem. And Dogen says that good and evil are not things that sort of exist waiting to be done. It's in your own action moment to moment where these things happen. And if you don't want evil to exist in the world, it's quite simple. All you have to do is at every moment when you have an ethical choice facing you, choose the right thing, you know, which is sometimes difficult for us because life is complicated and things are often not black and white. But one of the reasons we do this meditation practice is this belief, which I would argue has been tested by meditators for thousands of years, that we do have an innate sense of right and wrong, and that if you are quiet enough, you can comprehend that. You can kind of see it at the moment of action. Oh, this is what I ought to be doing. It doesn't mean you'll always do it, but you can start to see it dimly at first, and then a little better as you go along. And that's it. So I just called that chapter "Don't Be a Jerk" after that little revelation, and went on from that. And I think it's a good title for the book ultimately, because like God is disappointed in you. The guy figured the message of the Bible was God is disappointed in you. And I feel like one of the biggest messages that Dogen is trying to convey is don't be a jerk. Just don't be a jerk.
You know, I really love that. And for me, it works on two levels. It works on that practical level that you're talking about, but it also works on a much grander philosophical level, in that I think one of the things that is a stumbling block for many people, it certainly was for me, is the question, the larger question of evil and how can evil exist, and you know, why are these starving children, and what are we doing about it, and all this stuff. And I think that looking at it from a much bigger perspective is what can I do is not look down, you know, not look down, always look up. The secret of the ascent is to always look up and know that the path, the journey that you're on is the same journey that everyone else is on. And if everyone did the same thing, it'd all be okay. So I love the way that it has an immediacy that you're talking about, that you can experience it in your life, but it kind of works in a very broadly philosophical sense as well.
Yeah, it's really important. I think that's incredibly important, especially in our world today, because we have access to tremendous power as individuals that has not been available to individuals at any time in history, and that, as far as we can see with technology, is only going to become more and more the case. So, you know, you look at the attacks on New York City, September 11th, 2001, it was the kind of thing that at if up until that moment was probably only conceivable to be done by an extremely large group of people, like a nation. You know, you'd have to have a whole country behind you to do something like that. And now we can do it with just a handful of people, with the technology that's available. And that means we're in a very dangerous situation as a species. And the only way out of that is for people to become more and more aware of real ethical action that transcends even what you're angry about politically and what you think should be done with the world and all of that. When you're saying, I don't want to go and hurt those people because that, you know, that's a very, you know, that's a very immediate sort of thing that doesn't help. So there must be some other way to make the situation better, which I think is also the case. I think we really need to better our overall situation as human beings, but also acknowledge that we've been doing that. You know, things are not great for everybody in the world, certainly, and there's a lot of poverty and sickness and misery in the world, but I think it's probably statistically less miserable if you actually parse it all out over the vast amount of people there are, and that's a trend we ought to keep trying to improve until we finally get it right, until everybody is living as good a life as they possibly can. I'd like to see that continue.
Wow, you took that in a totally different direction than I would have, but that's okay. I'll tell you what, this has really been a great conversation. Tell folks a little bit more about where you're at, how they can find you. You have a great blog. You write great essays. You're a terrific writer. It's super accessible, but with a lot of meaning packed in there, something you can really chew on. Tell folks more about that.
Well, the main way to find me is my blog, which is hardcorezen.info. So it's .info because we couldn't get the other dots that are available. So hardcore zen is one word.
Hard to imagine who else has hardcore zen out there and is holding on to it so dearly.
Yeah, we could talk about that for a while. Right. Cause there is somebody. Right. But yeah, so that's it, and it's got my blog, and it's got links to everything else that you need. New World Library is my publisher, and they've got a website. You can find other stuff that's related to what I do on there as well.
Awesome, and I really hope people check it out, as well as check out this latest book, Don't Be a Jerk, because it's really a good one. Brad, it's been terrific having you on. Thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again to Brad Warner for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the question I tee up from this interview, and it's a very much of a Skeptico 3.0 kind of question, that is, moving past all that materialistic nonsense and no need to argue about it, it's so silly, it's so in the past. Let's talk about what moves us forward towards really figuring this stuff out. And in that sense, I guess I'd ask the very broad question, what do you make of Zen? And let me ask it with my kind of simplified understanding of Zen, and that is that everything we want to know can come from a very simple practice of sitting and just examining what comes up. Now, I'm sure I've oversimplified maybe to the point of butchering the essential elements of a Zen practice, but then correct me if I have, and tell me what you think of Zen, why you think it works, or maybe what you think are the weaknesses of that practice. So the place to let me know your thoughts is through the Skeptico website, skeptiko.com, where you can jump on over to the forum. You do have to send me a little note first so I know that you're a real person, but I love that process. Y'all have been sending me little emails and telling me who you are, and that's a great way for me to get to know you as you're coming through the doorway of the forum. So please do that. Go through the registration process, send me a little email, and we'll get you signed up. And even if you're just reading posts or just liking posts, I think you'll find it a good experience. And if you don't, tell me that too so we can improve it and make it better. While you're at the Skeptico website, be sure to subscribe to the show, iTunes, Stitcher, whatever podcatcher you might have. Like us on Facebook, like us anyplace else, subscribe to the newsletter. All the usual stuff is there, plus over 300 shows that you can download for free. So I have a couple of good shows coming up, including Bernardo Kastrup, who is always a great guest and always good to catch up on, and an old-school skeptical face-off with a very well-known mainstream scientist, skeptic, atheist type that I think you'll find very interesting. So do stick around for all of that. But until next time, take care and bye for now.